Welcome to Upahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the African continent. I'm Kimmy Dion, one of your hosts, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rachel Beatty Riedel, who this week launched the Center on Global Democracy at Cornell University. So congratulations, Rachel, and tell us all about it. What do you hope to do with this new Center on Global Democracy?
Thanks so much, Kim. I'm so thrilled and just really excited for this urgent work that's close to my heart that you and I talk about, you know, often with this podcast. And it's really an exciting time, you know, for us to be launching this center, which is going to be focused on research as well as, you know, kind of educational mission regarding the student involvement. But really, the goal is to bring together leading experts from across the university, you know, all of my amazing colleagues at Cornell who are working on this in American politics, from political theory, in comparative politics, and those with an IR approach to thinking about democracy, and with our colleagues and partners from across the world, to really bring together folks who are addressing questions of how democracy is under threat, how it's breaking down. And then, as you and I have been working on a project together around in your recent piece in JOD, Journal Democracy on Malawi, shows what strategies there are for democratic resistance and what types of institutional levers can be used, and what kinds of structural factors and the like serve as sources of resilience. So really, you know, digging into these critical questions, looking across the globe at places that serve as lessons for how democracy can be supported, bolstered, fought for, expanded in response to the ways in which it's being contested and torn down and really threatened. So these are big questions we're going to tackle, and we look forward to kind of serving as this focal point and hub to bring people together around these conversations. So stay tuned for more.
Yeah, that's so great. I mean, after these years of you leading the iNowdy Center for International Studies, it makes sense that, you know, I think it's so often that universities, American universities, right, those located in the United States, when they talk about democracy, they're so insular and they're so focused on, and I completely understand, we're in a bit of a moment here, right? Democracy is under threat, right? And so, because of that, there's certainly a need. But as you point out, right, the places where we can look for inspiration, right, if we care about democracy and safeguarding it and resisting backsliding, mm-hmm. It's going to be important for us to look at other experiences around the world. And I think, you know, this is a lesson I learned a long time ago, really, when I first started studying African politics.
Exactly.
It was because, you know, African politics is so rich, right? Because, you know, we've got scores of countries in Africa. And so there's a lot of variation, and there's, you know, a lot of, there's also a very long history, right? So if we think about not just like, you know, democratic politics in the 21st century, but if we think about the way people practice collective governance,
exactly.
And respect and mutuality, right? There's a long history of that in the African setting. And so, and certainly I imagine in other regions around the world. So it's really exciting that you're doing this. I'm so thrilled for you. And I'm so excited about what the center is going to do and what all of us are going to learn from it. And for sure, we're going to be following here on Upahamu Africa, all things Africa that the center is doing. So,
absolutely.
Exactly. So our listeners should stay tuned for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so true. You know, when we think about the ways in which we observe civic participation, right, claiming democracy and translating that democracy into the kinds of governance and public services and the ability to live in security and peace. That's what we want from our democratic systems, you know, the respect, the liberty, the freedom, the governance. So all of this connects to what can we learn from each place and what can we learn from looking back in time and in this current moment. And so we'll have a lot to continue to bring to this podcast from all the great lessons that we learn from our research and from all of our colleagues' research who are working in Africa.
That's awesome. So this week, Sadly, marks a year of brutal war in Sudan. And there's an excellent op-ed in Foreign Policy this week reflecting on the year of war and how we shouldn't think of Sudan as a lost cause. And I'll quote what NYU graduate student Suha Musa writes in Foreign Policy a bit at length. So, readers or listeners, bear with us. More than 15,000 people have been killed in war-related violence. Over 8 million people have been displaced, and widespread hunger is increasing. Though this language is attention-grabbing and quotable, it has restricted the international community's response to the conflict. This style of language, which effectively dismisses many conflict zones as lost causes, is a constant in humanitarian crises. It is often used to suggest the international community's supposed inability to alleviate suffering. However, in the case of Sudan, as in many wars before, including Syria and now Gaza, this fatalistic rhetoric perpetuates harmful myths, distorting the reality of the conflict, keeping genuine progress at bay, and ultimately contributing to prolonged suffering. Now, Musa points out that this kind of rhetoric gives the international community cover for not paying attention to what is happening in Sudan, for turning away from the severe human costs from this war. And, as I was reading her article, I kept thinking back to May Hassan and Ahmed Kaduta's essay in Foreign Affairs last year that urged the international community to do something before it was too late, right? They were writing very early in the start of conflict. We weren't even sure it was going to be a war when they wrote that essay. And they were trying to get the international community to act, to not look away. And Musa's essay in Foreign Policy this week is a great reminder that it's actually never too late to pay attention to what's happening in Sudan. If yesterday was a better day, today's the second best. Let's make sure the international community is supporting people's everyday people's needs, right? What are the basic needs for, right? As you were just saying, when it comes to democracy, like security, peace, but also, their basic needs, right? To feed themselves and their children and have access to clean water, right? These kind of everyday needs that people have and are unable to access, many of them because of the disruption and the violence in this war. So to support the everyday needs that people have as they navigate this humanitarian disaster, and the international community should not just be paying attention, should not just be providing humanitarian relief, but should also be supporting a way forward out of the war.
Exactly.
Just kind of thinking about all of this, Rachel and I decided, to commemorate what we think is really important that we should all be paying attention to. We're going to re-up the interview that Rachel did with Nisrin El-Amin, not even 6 months ago. To try to help people understand what is happening in Sudan. So we're re-upping that earlier episode that Rachel has with Nisrin so that people can have a better understanding of the people perpetuating, right, the kind of political elites that are perpetuating this war and what it means for ordinary people to try to navigate this, because unfortunately, there's still suffering. There's still violence, and there's still a lot that needs to be done to meet people's needs and to make a way out of the war.
Exactly right, Kim. And I'm glad, we'll have this conversation from Nisreen and, really helping us to understand the domestic dynamics at play, the domestic politics at play. And to your point, the role of the international community, how large that looms. It also makes me think of this article I just read this week about Niger and the ways in which the geopolitics are so quickly changing in Niger. And I think it's really just a signal about the kinds of pressures and tensions and rebalancing that's happening more broadly across the continent. So in Niger this last week, there were large anti-American protests in the capital city of Niamey, Demanding that US troops leave the country. Now, I'll remind our listeners that US hosts a military base there of over 1,000 troops. And their major activity right now, I believe, is using drone surveillance to monitor jihadi activity across the region. So it's really a kind of Sahelian base for the United States. Now, these anti-American protests were mobilized by, supported by, kind of whipped up by the ruling military junta. And they followed just days after a fairly large replacement for Moscow's Wagner Group, the new Africa Corps, arrived in Niger. So, the timing here is really significant. Russia and Niger signed a defense pact last December. The Africa Corps troops are arriving. And now Niger's military leadership also posted audio on social media in which their leaders are complaining that the bilateral cooperation with the United States is not serving Niger's interests, that it was illegal. The agreement signed in 2012 is they're now considered to be illegal, and that they don't see a partnership with American military around these security operations as serving their interests. Now, I think this is a really interesting moment and conversation. We've seen this kind of anti-American military rhetoric more broadly across the continent in response to kind of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the US kind of pressuring allies to make a choice between the US or Russia, ratcheting up that pressure, which authoritarian leaders in particular can respond to and, raise the kind of anti-Western concern because this language appears patronizing, it appears controlling, it could very easily appear neo-colonial. At the same time, in Niger, the military junta is quite capable of using this anti-West argument to also push public opinion against US and Western pressures and sanctions to reinitiate democratic elections and civilian rule, right? So it's a very interesting geopolitical balancing that they're attempting to pull off. Last month, Niger ended its military agreement with the United States, citing reasons of a quote unquote condescending attitude of US officials in attempting to lecture Niamey over their ties with not only Russia, but also with Iran. Niger is pursuing a mining deal with Iran, ongoing, conversations with China. Niger has also ejected diplomats and troops from former colonial power France and revoked an anti-migration deal that they had brokered with the European Union, which has led to a new surge of migration, in particular, kind of human traffickers, smugglers through Niger as this trans-Sahelian route, a really important route of trafficking that links Latin America to Europe as well. So Niger has been, clear that this geopolitical competition offers them an array of partners, and this is a broader trend across the continent, and that US policy needs to align with the interests of the country that they're representing, but that our US kind of foreign policy ability to hold authoritarian leaders accountable in this moment is really a changing landscape quite quickly.
You know, that's really hard to think about. I mean, so it's probably not a surprise to our listeners that Rachel and I are American Gen Xers who like were alive during the Cold War. So, you know, we have like our own like historical feelings about the Soviets and Russians and like, so of course that's going to color some of, how we think about these things. But I don't think there's a serious entity in a serious thinker person in the world who doesn't say, like, democracy is not a priority of Russia, right? Like, that's, and so, like, for those of us who are small D Democrats, right, who think that there's some benefit to having popular participation and governance and, popular feelings represented in our governments, that there is concern about Russia and other regimes that may not respect, popular governance. Okay, so the hard part, though, is that doesn't mean that the U.S. gets to be a big bully in Sahel. Like, you just can't do, like, selling in countries, like, you, and you can't be like, well, we need to protect ourselves, so we're going to throw some bases over here, and you're going to do what we wish, because you're not really a democracy, and, like, we want to give you these things, but you need to be a democracy. I mean, we can't be a bully, right? And so it's kind of like, it's, I don't know, I guess I'm saying this is kind of hard, because, and I'm probably just thinking aloud here for our listeners, but I'm just, I would like for Nigerians to have a say in who governs them and how they're governed and what public services are offered, right? I want all of those things. I want a government that, you know, provides for their needs and prosperity, like not even just their basic needs, but that the government is thinking about their prosperity. I want that. And I can't say that they're not totally doing that, right? That even if they may not be a democratically elected government, it sounds like they're standing up to a bully, and the bully is us. And, but that means they're not making good friends, or friends that I would not choose for them to make. So it's, I don't know, this is making me think of Emmanuel Balogun's expertise in, West Africa and Africa and international relations. And also it's making me just think of some words that we said earlier in today's show, right, about respect and mutuality, right? I think if, you know, we don't just think about that as like within a state, but between states, right? So some of what you're saying, Rachel, right, about this situation in Niger where there's lots of external actors vying for influence, and the kind of higher, holier than thou, higher and mightier, United States is being rejected, right? Then we have to wonder about what comes in place of seemingly democratic, seemingly democracy promoting regimes. And that's going to be the ones that we know to not be democratic, to not be democracy promoting. And then it makes one wonder, like, it's not just like the U.S. and Russia or U.S. and China battling it out for influence in the world. But what are the consequences for Nigerians in the future? What will that mean for them? And this is why, like, I don't care for international relations so much. It's just not like, that's not the tea I'm drinking in political science. Like, I'm really a domestic politics girl. Like, that's what I do. And that's why, for me, in this case, the foreign relations between countries really matters, because I'm thinking about what that's going to mean for the domestic politics of Niger in the future, right? And that's why I'm so glad that your center, right, when you were talking about it earlier today, I'm glad that it's also going to include people who do international relations, because it can kind of tell us, I hope, right? Mm-hmm. What does it mean, like, when you have relationships with certain types of countries? Does that mean democracy is more likely? Because if what I want for Nigerians is the same that I want for myself, and that is to live in peace, for my children to have opportunities, mm-hmm. for me and my family and my community to not be hungry, right? To have like our basic needs met, but also for us to have a chance at prosperity. Like, I want that for Nigerians too. Like, I don't think that I should have won some sort of like a lottery that I get to be born in a place that's more prosperous. Like, I want Nigerians to feel heard by their governments and to get services from their government. And I don't know that they're going to get that hanging out with the Russians. And we're just talking about, you know, Russia and, you know, of course, it's, especially for Americans, China's always also in the back of their mind, but also like, what's Turkey doing in mm-hmm. these places mm-hmm. too? And that's why, like, maybe we need to bring Emmanuel Balogun back on the show and have him tell us like what more he's researching and learning and thinking about relations between countries, especially in the Sahel, where we're having this really kind of critical moment for democratic governance.
Exactly. I mean, the Sahel is such a key zone in terms of thinking about national borders mean a lot, but then all of a sudden they don't mean a lot in terms of security. And, you know, what's happening in Niger will also affect what's happening in Burkina.
For sure.
And so, yeah, we really, you know, our listeners stay tuned because we'll have more on this, which is, you know, an ongoing conversation, but really one that is a key question between the international, the regional forces, and then the domestic politics. And at the end of the day, with the goal of citizens being able to thrive.
Yeah. And if our listeners have people they want to hear from or things they think we should be reading about the, you know, various foreign actors vying for influence in the Sahel, let us know. Send us an email at ufahamuafrica@gmail.com. And you can find links to everything we've mentioned in this news wrap and later in the episode we're reposting at ufahamuafrica.com. But now let's turn to that earlier recording of Rachel's conversation with Nisrin El Amin.
All right. Welcome, Nisrin El Amin. We are so pleased to have you here on the podcast and with us here at Cornell University. It's really a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm particularly glad that we can have this conversation because we would love for you to explain to our listeners a little bit about what's happening in Sudan to put into context the conflict that we are not necessarily reading enough about in the newspapers and hearing about through the media. So can you tell our listeners kind of how you would describe what's happening now and how you might root it in longer histories of Sudan?
Yes, thank you. So, I mean, I would describe the current war as a power struggle between kind of two factions of the military coup regime. There was a coup in October of 2021. And in April of this year, essentially the Rapid Support Forces, which is a state-sanctioned militia, and the Sudanese armed forces, you know, started fighting in the capital, Khartoum, and vying really for economic and political power of the country as we were coming closer to, you know, a potential sort of tilting during the transitional period of power towards civilians. And so part of how people explain what triggered this is that there was an agreement in December of 2022 that essentially outlined how the army was going to integrate the Rapid Support Forces into its ranks. And also the agreement also had some provisions around military elites handing over or giving civilian oversight over companies that they were owning. So just for your listeners to know, about 80% of Sudan's economy is controlled by military elites. On the one side, you have the gold trade that is mostly controlled by the Rapid Support Forces. And on the other hand, you have about 200 companies controlled by elites within the army, construction, rubber, wheat, and other commodities. And so there was a kind of push during the transition to really have those companies be, you know, overseen by civilians. So I think those two things triggered it. I mean, there's much larger kind of underlying issues that caused this war. And I would describe it as a long war that really started in 1955, right, with the beginning of the South Sudanese War. We could even trace it further back to the 19th century, but yeah, I think that's how I would describe it. And I wanted to maybe read a short excerpt from something that I wrote recently
Absolutely.
To kind of just, yeah, historically situate this. So Sudan's December Revolution, which started in 2018, is often compared to Sudan's 1964 revolution, sparked by clashes between students and police at the University of Khartoum before mushrooming into a kind of broader movement that toppled Aboud's military regime, or to the 1985 revolution triggered by price hikes that toppled Jafar Nimeiri's regime. But I would like to trace its genealogy back to the 1950s. And I'll begin at independence. Britain's parting gift to Sudan at independence in 1956 was an economy dependent on the extraction of cash crops like cotton and on the exploitation of farmers and landless workers, and a political system which was constructed to serve the interests of a riverine central Sudanese elite at the expense of the south and other peripheral regions, but also of a rural population that sustained this extractive export-oriented economy. Some of the initial forms of resistance against the new post-colonial state unsurprisingly came from tenant farmers who organized to demand, among other things, a greater share of profits as world cotton prices plummeted. A strike took place on a cotton scheme near Kosi shortly after independence, and the state responded with extreme violence. Over 300 striking tenant farmers were shot on the fields or suffocated in detention cells. Elders in my family are still haunted by the tragedy of farmers suffocating in overcrowded, kind of poorly ventilated cells. A year earlier, Sudan's first civil war had broken out between South Sudanese demanding political representation and regional autonomy, and the central government, who had essentially subsumed the South as a quasi-internal colony. This 1956 massacre is linked to the civil war because striking farmers were threatening existing capitalist labor relations that allowed ruling elites to extract maximum profits to fund its repressive campaign against southern rebels. And I think this moment is important because it reveals the way state violence in Sudan has long been shaped by the need to reproduce and maintain an extractive war economy that serves elite interests by any means necessary. And in more recent decades, certainly under the al-Bashir regime, we saw this manifest itself in the form of an ethno-nationalist, monocultural Islamist project being imposed on a multi-ethnic, multilingual, multi-religious country in violent ways. And we saw this play itself out in Darfur, where a state-sanctioned campaign of unimaginable violence led by the Janjaweed, now known as the Rapid Support Forces, was carried out beginning in 2003. And during this genocide, hundreds of thousands were killed, entire villages were wiped out, millions were displaced. And while this campaign went through various phases, this violence never really ended. It fell out of the headlines, but it never ended. It expanded. And the long war essentially came to the capital on April 15th. And so we see this play itself out now with, as I mentioned, various military action actors and factions vying not only for political, but also economic control of the country. And so while it started as a power struggle in April, it has expanded in ways that are really concerning. At the moment, I think many of us are worried that we're seeing the RSF gain ground in the western part of Sudan, Darfur, but also other areas, and essentially pushing the army out. And really, we're seeing very similar violence that we saw in 2003. And then you see the army in other parts of the country. They're still fighting in central Sudan, especially around Khartoum. But there are, you know, Port Sudan and other, the eastern parts, kind of central and northern parts of Sudan, you see the army have, you know, remain in control. And so there's a fear that we might see a kind of splintering of the state, right? Mm-hmm. That began with South Sudan seceding in 2011, in part because we haven't really dealt with the roots of this violence in Sudan.
Exactly. Yeah. And then when you say that the RSF, you know, the kind of violence that they're, that is happening, harkens back to 2003, does that mean in the sense a kind of, you know, targeting, how would you describe the ways in which the violence is affecting civilians? How is it affecting, you know, kind of everyday life in Sudan, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I was in Khartoum in April and the war broke out, I had never seen something like this in Khartoum, right? We were surrounded by bombs, missiles, explosions. The RSF was mostly on the ground, while the Sudanese armed forces were kind of controlling the airspace, mm-hmm. right? And it was fairly random in a sense. I mean, they were fighting each other in the capital, targeting, important kind of infrastructures of power, if you will. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, Sudan, I mean, Khartoum is a city of millions. I think it's about, 7 to 9 million, depending on how you calculate it, because it's made up of kind of three sister cities. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very densely populated capital city, and we're all caught in this violence. Now, when the violence started in Darfur, I should say it even in March, before the war started, there was continuing to be violence in Darfur. But when this kind of phase of the war came to Darfur, it took on a different form. Mm. As bad as it was in Khartoum, we saw in Darfur, in particular in the western city of Al Janina, much more targeted killings that were, targeting particular ethnic groups, the Masalit in particular. There was one day, I think it was in June, where 1,000 people were killed. And of course, there are no bodies that are officially able to kind of gather data on this. But what we know is that El Janina has essentially been cleansed, if you will. Mm. People have had to flee to Chad, and on the journey have also been targeted. And so it really harkens back to what happened in 2003. And the origins of that, I think, are also not often enough talked about, mm-hmm. Which is that you had these Arab-identified ethnic groups from which the RSF draws many of its kind of recruits, mm-hmm. Who come from these kind of Arab-identified pastoralist groups, who for centuries had been moving across the landscape of Darfur, but with desertification, there was kind of increasing conflict over land, right, mm-hmm. with more sedentary kind of farming communities, including the Thor and the Masalit, who are African identified. And part of what happened in 2003 is that the Sudanese government, instead of de-escalating these conflicts, ended up, arming the pastoralists, and who then became the Janjaweed, to attack these communities. And, we've had for decades, if not centuries, traditional methods of resolving conflicts where a third party would come in and peace agreements would be signed and conflicts were resolved. Mm-hmm. And so what this did is it really undermined those systems, yes. that had been in place for so long. And so I think this is part of what I look at now in my work, at the way that pastoralists, because of agribusiness and kind of other corporate Gulf investments, et cetera, continue to be marginalized and as a result become vulnerable to recruitment, right. by groups like the RSF. And that is not at all, of course, to excuse any of this violence, but to explain that in order for us to not keep going back to this never again violence, right, we have to address the root causes, which include addressing the grievances of marginalized groups across the country.
Absolutely.
I think what has happened in Janina and what is now happening in other parts of Darfur, the same thing that happened in Janina just last week happened, in the last couple of days happened in other parts of Darfur. And it is horrific. I mean, I have a close friend who was in Niala until quite recently, and she said she had not experienced this kind of violence before, even though she lived through the 2003 genocide. And so I think that, to me, gave me a lot of pause to think about how is it that we are living once again through something like this. And for the most part, the world has remained silent. And it's not to say that I, for one, I'm not an advocate of international intervention, mm-hmm. but I am in the sense of, you know, a military intervention or something like this. Mm-hmm. But I am in support of the war criminals not being legitimized and propped up through these continued so-called peace talks that are happening in Jeddah, mm-hmm. That really provide a green light for this to continue, mm-hmm. that legitimize the war rather than allow us as Sudanese, should have happened a long time ago, to bring the perpetrators of the violence that happened in 2003. I mean, Al-Burhan and Hemeti's as the head of the RSF, mm-hmm. Al-Burhan, the head of the Sudanese armed forces, are war criminals whose crimes span decades, exactly. You know, including in Darfur. And the fact that they continue mm-hmm. to be propped up and legitimized as potential reformists, as potential peacemakers, mm-hmm. Is partly what has gotten us, you know, to be at the stage of that something like this can happen again.
Exactly, that they're the stakeholders, so to speak, who are brought around the table. And so I want there are so many things here that are really important to kind of dig into. And one is, right, this international role. And while, you know, there's a big scale on the spectrum from international intervention to what we might think of as using international forums for justice, or thinking about the kinds of dialogues and who's involved around peace, to on the other end of the scale, just like mere awareness of what's happening, concern, right, knowledge. So what do you think, given that, I mean, it seems as though the kind of conversation around Sudan is at the global level really off the map because of many other tragedies and atrocities, but also, you know, even maybe for other reasons as well. So how would you situate that in terms of the role of the international and some of the vacuum around knowledge or engagement?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So I think maybe one thing I'll start with, because we haven't talked about it yet, is the humanitarian situation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, recently the UN issued a report that stated that we are currently the largest internal displacement crisis in the world, with over 7.1 million people displaced. And that includes some who were displaced before the war. And some people estimate that it's actually closer to 10 million. It's obviously hard in this context to gather data with very few international organizations on the ground. Mm-hmm. We have 19 million children that are out of school. The vast majority of hospitals in the areas that are affected by this war are not operating anymore. I have relatives who remain in and around Khartoum who are diabetic, for example, who cannot access medication. Mm-hmm. There are people who are dying of malaria because they cannot access medication. About 25 million Sudanese, and you know, we have a population of about 45 million, is at risk of famine, essentially, in a country that was once touted as the breadbasket of the Middle East, right? Mm-hmm. And so the fact that this, you know, that Sudan is one of the sort of largest humanitarian crises, I don't like to use the word crises, but mm-hmm. For this particular purpose in the world, and that there's very little attention on it, I think is about several things. I think part of it has to do with the fact that wars in Africa, and particularly in the Horn, are normalized due to anti-Black racism, and it's sort of seen as, you know, this is an internal conflict that has been going on for so long, and it's very complicated, and you know, it's far away from us. When in reality, I mean, the political economy of war makes us all complicit, right? If we think about the military companies that are benefiting from this, the corporate interests that are, you know, at stake here. I study Gulf, specifically Emirati and Saudi land investments in Sudan, mm-hmm. And over the past 2 decades under al-Bashir, but also during the transition, Saudis and Emiratis have invested a combined $27 billion in Sudanese land and real estate and infrastructure projects. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have to understand the role of Saudi Arabia in Jeddah in the talks and the peace talks that just concluded that did not lead to a ceasefire. as within that context, right, of the Gulf also wanting to maintain its, to protect its investments, to maintain stability over any form of democratic civilian rule. And, you know, we also have to think about the ways that, for example, the European Union in 2014 used the Khartoum process, which was about kind of essentially externalizing the European Union's border to the region between Sudan, Egypt, and Libya, mm-hmm. Paid the Sudanese government under al-Bashir at the time around $200 million to militarize that border. And al-Bashir used the RSF for that. Mm-hmm. And so there you saw a kind of beginning of a legitimization of the Janjaweed, right, turning and a kind of expansion of their transnational network. So you saw a kind of, they had already been legitimized prior to that, but actually, especially during the civil war in Yemen, the Saudi coalition used both RSF troops and Sudanese armed forces troops to fight in that war. And again, you know, thereby expanding their transnational networks of support. And so I think part of what happens is that because the U.S. has mostly played a more kind of diplomatic role, in my view, really undermining the more radical elements of the revolution and of who are calling for very clearly for a transition to full civilian rule from the very beginning after al-Bashir was ousted in April of 2019. And we saw during the transitional period, power was always tilted in favor of the military elites, even though civilian elites were kind of brought into the fold. And the United Nations, under kind of, you know, the US, the UK, United Arab Emirates, were essentially during the transitional period, not only sidelining neighborhood resistance committees, for example, which are these grassroots committees at the neighborhood level that formed really in the kind of Arab Spring 2013 moment. I mean, they have their origins traced back even further, but to mobilize people in protest against the state, but we're also filling a kind of vacuum left behind by an essentially absent state. To provide, yeah, services and support to people in their neighborhoods. They were the ones, for example, who led the COVID-19 kind of awareness campaign and so forth, that they were really, they had set out revolutionary charters that said no partnership, no legitimacy, and no negotiations with the military elites, both before and after the coup. And were really not taken seriously as political actors, even though there are 8,000 of them across the country. They're hierarchically organized, but quite highly like coordinated and and so, you know, there were times when, for example, the UNITAMP's negotiations team asked them, you know, to join the negotiation table. There was one moment I remember when the resistance committee said they would, but only if it was a Facebook like. Aired live on Facebook, right, to make that process more transparent, and the negotiations team refused. And so there was a purposeful, I think, marginalization of those more radical elements of the revolution in favor of a process that, that prioritized stability over popular democracy. But my point is that even though the U.S., I mean, they have their own corporate interests, but the U.S. in Sudan isn't playing as big of a role as the Gulf players, in my view. Russia has also recently entered, not so recently, but has entered the war as well, both the Wagner Group and the Russian state, mostly on the side of the RSF. So the U.S.'s role has been also shaped by its very myopic policy around countering kind of Russian and Chinese influence on the continent rather than on thinking about what is best for Sudan, right? And so I think part of what's happening that I see on the US left, at least, is that we need to decenter U.S. empire in some ways, and the U.S. in order to better understand the political economy of this war and how we are all implicated in it. In some ways, it's the Gulf states, the allies of the United States, that are shaping U.S. policy towards Sudan. It doesn't really have a policy, if you will. Mm-hmm. And again, I should say that I am, and this is, you know, my own kind of politics, I feel like this is a moment. The revolution was an opportunity to say hands off Sudan, right? To really have all of these negative forms of international intervention kind of be exposed and removed. We've now come to a point where it's hard to imagine that. And we do need pressure on the warring factions who are mostly accountable to these external actors who are fueling the war. Mm-hmm. Egypt, for example, is fueling the war on the Sudanese armed forces side, right? So to have peace talks that don't include the Gulf, the UAE in particular, or Egypt, means that they won't be able to leverage the kind of pressure needed to actually bring about a ceasefire, which is what's needed at the moment. I mean, a couple of months ago when I was talking about this, you know, the people that I, you know, my mentors would say, we need the international community to have a coordinated effort, right, to bring about a ceasefire. At that time, there were three tracks. There was an AU IGAD peace talk track, there was an Egypt track, and there was the Jeddah track. And that once that ceasefire happens, then we need to kind of step out of the way and let the resistance committees and the kind of civilian actors who have been sidelined in this transition process guide what the next steps are. That process needed to be much more Sudanese-led, more civilian-led, and also led by people in the peripheries that have been impacted by this long war in a way that the center has not. Mm-hmm. So far, the Sudanese armed forces has signed 27 peace agreements over the last couple of decades. And none of them have led to peace, right? And so peace is really being used as a currency here to legitimize continued state violence. And I think, yeah, this is a moment to rethink that model that hasn't worked.
And to rethink it then, both, as you're suggesting, international actors who are fueling the conflict and in some ways legitimizing through those peace deals. And as well as you're mentioning, the role of civil society and domestic actors. And one of the things I wanted to have you tell us a little bit more about is the landscape of what we might call civil society. And Sudan certainly has this iconic imagery of the importance of civil society during the revolution, the role of women, youth, et cetera. But then also, as you're saying, there's so much about organization through the neighborhood groups, the neighborhood resistance committees. And those seem, to my uneducated eye, like very interestingly structured and in a way that maybe is distinct from what we think of as kind of formalized NGOs and more politicized or institutionalized, internationally linked civil society groups that often maybe become detached from a more grassroots politics, needs, social services. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about this landscape of civil society, how it's structured, and then what role could they have and do they have towards that piece, that really meaningful piece?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a very important question. Especially because I think in many ways, the Sudanese revolution could and has served as a model for what popular democracy and a kind of challenge to elite politics in the region might look like. So, I mean, I should start by saying that the Bashir regime, when it came to power in 1989, one of its mandates was to really decimate and kind of undermine trade unions and kind of civil society, the vibrant civil society that in the past had challenged military rule. We've mostly, most of our life, most of Sudan's, you know, post-colonial life has, we've been under military rule. And so they're kind of learning from the past. And so through that effort, much of the kind of more, again, radical organizing went underground. The 90s was a particularly brutal era of repression, where people were tortured, imprisoned, many people went into exile. And we saw a kind of parallel emergence of a kind of civil society that was very much controlled by the state. So NGOs that were really state entities in a way that would be registered through something called the HAC, which is an agency that legitimizes NGOs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But again, parallel to that, you did see the emergence of kind of civil society that in many ways resisted NGOization, mm-hmm. right? That so these neighborhood resistance committees, especially over the last decade, also unions. I work in rural parts of Sudan where there are definitely neighborhood resistance committees, but there are also other civil society formations like unions, like this farmers union. It's an independent union that kind of emerged in response to the kind of more government affiliated union. To really challenge the government's practice of privatizing and pushing neoliberal reforms in the agricultural sector that forced a lot of small farmers into debt, who then sold their land to state elites as part of their project of attracting Gulf investors, for example. And so, you also have in this region of Sudan called the Jazeera, which is kind of like a delta right south of Khartoum, very fertile area of land. Most of the labor performed on those farms is performed, 70% of it is performed by landless farm workers, some of whom are displaced from the various regions of Sudan that had been at war. But also you have a community of people who are Sudanese, but originally from northern Nigeria, so they're Hausa, who settled when the British established the Jazeera scheme, kind of recruited, they were on their way to Mecca and stayed. And so they have their own associations that are very much challenging the legal framework that we inherited from the British that has allowed the state to dispossess people of their land. And so there are, I think, these really vibrant kind of civil society formations. In fact, the period between the ousting of al-Bashir in April of 2019 and the October 2021 coup saw an unprecedented number of civil disobedience kind of organizing from communities in South Kordofan successfully organizing against mining companies and their use of cyanide and mercury. Mm-hmm. To the teachers union in Darfur, organizing strikes, port workers in Port Sudan, organizing against the privatization of that port. There have been many people who have been, the Russians, the Turkish government has tried to kind of acquire parts of that port. And, you know, so they've organized against that. And so there have been the longest worker strikes in Sudan's history during this period as well. So I think what we really saw during the revolution was a kind of politicization of civil society in a way that not only that sort of defied or resisted NGOization, but also kind of traditional opposition party politics. Right. And so the resistance committees have purposefully not aligned themselves with opposition parties. In fact, they're ideologically, I mean, the organizing kind of happens across ideological lines. And the committees are quite different, you know, whether because there are some in very wealthy neighborhoods in Khartoum, and then there are some in, you know, more rural parts of the country or, you know, in cities in Darfur, where the analysis, the political analysis around what needs to happen for Sudan to finally become free, if you will, and fully democratic is different, right? Based on people's relationship to the state and state violence. So I think, you know, what's important for me, for people to understand is that these same resistance committees that were not taken seriously during the transition as political actors are now essentially doing the work of an absent state and of an absent international humanitarian community, right? In the areas that are most kind of hard hit by the war, Khartoum, Darfur, Kordofan, they, members of resistance committees have organized something called emergency response rooms. They've, you know, organized communal kitchens. These response rooms attend to the medical needs of people. They distribute food. People have been converting schools into displacement shelters. And I should say that this is amidst war, right? I mean, there are people, these volunteers are being targeted, imprisoned, some of them forcibly, people tried to forcibly recruit some people into either side. And there are some resistance committees that have started siding with the army because of the way this war has evolved. But all that to say that I think that to us should show us that the resistance committees are very capable of guiding what the path forward should look like. I often, as a diaspora person, as a professor at the University of Toronto, get asked, you know, what is the path forward? How do we get out of this mess, right? And I say, you know, part of the problem is that the wrong people get asked that question. Mm-hmm. I, as a person in the diaspora, should not define, I should not answer that question, right? It needs to come from the people who remain, you know, on the ground, essentially continuing the revolution, right? Mm-hmm. This is a new phase of the revolution. And they're often not taken seriously and asked that question. And so that to me, I think is where we need to move, is to take the revolutionary charters that they've written seriously. There has been a civilian gathering in Addis Ababa recently, but it's again, mostly elites, and the resistance committees have not joined. And that also should give us pause, right? We should be asking what kind of forms need to be established for resistance and under what conditions, right? Under what terms do they need to be created in order for resistance committees to participate, right? Yes. Members of the resistance committees, some of whom are now in exile.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's really important, fascinating how the resistance committees themselves have been organized and what work they're doing under very difficult conditions. One of the other things that you've mentioned that I wanted to just dive into a little bit further is your use of the term kind of Arab identified or African identified communities. I wanted to discuss with you a little bit more about identities.
Sure.
Because I think it's really a key from the outside, or how things are painted, you know, well outside of the context. There have been these tropes or narratives around Arab versus African. And I think part of what's interesting about your work is an effort to trouble or destabilize and redress such markers as Arab and African, which is, I think, much more useful broadly, because then the ways in which these identities then get carried back into particular contexts and mobilized around the next stages of strategy. So I was wondering how you can, you know, explain to us the kind of relationship of the country's colonizing history, relationship to different peripheries. How do these identities come to be placed or taken up, and how are they maybe less a thing or solid than we might imagine?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is both a very important